This is In Ear Insights, the Trust Insights podcast. In this week's In Ear Insights, we are talking about public speaking, what it takes to become a public speaker, what are some of the best practices, what are things that you wish you'd known before becoming a public speaker, and so on and so forth. And today I want to start, actually, Katie, since prior to the founding of Trust Insights, public speaking was not something that you really entertained as something that was going to be a part of your career. But being the CEO of the company, there's a certain amount of public exposure and things that comes with the job. So share your experiences thus far about becoming a public speaker, particularly since your first foray was to a sold-out room of 1,000 people.
Yeah, so no pressure. You know, my experience so far has been positive. I'm fortunate to be in a company with two really seasoned public speakers, so I've been able to learn a lot from both you and John. And the thing that I probably naively misunderstood is how much work actually goes into preparing for talking in public, even if it's something that you know really well and can recite in your sleep. So I think that for me was the biggest lesson learned, was the amount of preparation. So for example, you and John pretty much put me on a regimented schedule, almost like a boot camp, to prepare me for speaking at Inbound last year, where every Friday at 11 a.m., I had to run through it with you. And I knew for myself, I had to have improved from the week before, because otherwise I'm just wasting your time. And I think the other really helpful thing was sort of doing that mock role-playing of you guys pretended to be audience members asking questions and throwing me curveballs so that I wouldn't stumble on stage as I'm trying to think through, okay, what kinds of answers sound intelligent? So it's public speaking is really difficult. I think that the thing for people to keep in mind is that people make a full-time job out of it, and it is a lot of work. It is not easy. Even if it comes naturally to you, there's still a lot of work and practice and preparation that goes into it. And, you know, I guess I would pose this question to you as someone who's been doing it for a long time. What is your experience when you started versus now?
When I started, I was terrible. I wish I had, you know, structure and mentors and folks to help improve it. But over the years and hanging out with other people who do it for a living and seeing sort of what their practices are, you can reverse engineer more or less what you're supposed to be doing. The biggest changes I've made over the years have been, first, making sure that what you're going to say on stage has a coherent flow to it and is an actual story, because people can't remember just the stuff you throw at them. It has to be in some kind of framework or story or structure so that they can see mentally where they are. A lot of my talks will have like 3 or 5 parts, but there are always slides that are or mental bookmarks of where you are. So we talk in our AI talk about mining, clustering, predicting, driving, and dimension reduction. And each time we're walking through this talk, we mention like, and now in the mining section, and now in the clustering section, so that people know, okay, I know where I am, and they have something to mentally latch onto. The performative aspect is probably the biggest help there was actually from Michael Port's book, Steal the Show, which I strongly recommend. You can pick it up on Amazon. It's like $11. But Michael's a theater and stage actor. And so a lot of what he talks about are making what you do on stage from your performance perspective congruent with your talk. So in one section, for example, he talks about blocking on stage. If you're walking through a 5-part framework, there's 5 different places on stage you should stand as you walk through the framework. So you're literally walking through the framework, you know, on stage. So that people mentally, again, mentally associate, oh, he's on part 2, he's in position 2 on the stage. And it helps you remember as well as a speaker, oh, I'm on part 2, I should be standing here.
What do you think are some of the biggest mistakes that speakers make, whether they're seasoned or new?
By far, the biggest mistake is trying to do too much. And this is something I am super guilty of, which is trying to cram too much into a talk because you either think you have to fill the time or you're nervous or something like that, instead of being very clear about what you talk about and having that message be clear and having something that repeats. So in your predictive talk, for example, you're constantly referring back to sort of this framework, this six-part predictive analytics framework. So again, people can keep in mind where they are in the story. The other thing that new speakers are vulnerable to, corporate speakers are super vulnerable to, is making the talk and the speaking about themselves and their company, as opposed to serving the audience. If you approach the stage as this is a sales opportunity for my company, that comes through. It's like that, you know, that person who's on a date who's like just like a little too eager, and they're in it for themselves and they're not in it for the other person. Well, I'm sure you've seen that on stage.
I have, and I was going to ask you about that. Of, you know, how much of your talk should be a sales pitch, and how much of your talk should be informative and educational.
I'm trying to remember who told me this. It might have been Tamsin Webster, but there's three parts you can do for a talk. There's why, what, and how. And your goal is to deliver two out of three, because that gives the audience what they're after, but it doesn't give them the complete picture. And it creates what's called an implicit sales pitch. Like, oh, I understand why predictive analytics is so important. I understand what it is. How do I do it? Hey, I'm going to go ask Katie because she just spoke about it for 45 minutes credibly on stage. Or I understand what this is and how it works, but you know, why is it important? How do I justify it to my CEO? I'm going to go talk to the speaker on stage and say, how do I sell this internally to my company? So the best speakers don't beat people over the head with the sales pitch. They create content that is a sales pitch in what leaves out. As an audience member, how do you feel when someone's like, and you should buy my book and my course? And
oh, and that's when you can hear the collective eye roll.
Uh-huh. Or every mobile phone goes up like, I'll play video
exactly.
games.
It's like those timeshare pitches where you think you're going in for one thing. It's the bait and switch.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and as an audience member, that's really frustrating. You want to be entertained. You want to be engaged and you want to learn something. And I think it's what the three E's, the educate, entertain, and engage. And it's the same framework that we use with our content, with our white papers, with our analysis of your goal is to always try to meet those three E's. And I think that I know from my standpoint, once I was comfortable with the content of the talk itself, that it was educational, then my biggest challenge was really to be engaging and entertaining because, you know, to your point, I've only just started in public speaking and, you know, I'm not a comedian. I don't tell jokes on stage. I personally think I'm hilarious, but, you know, I can be my own biggest fan of my terrible, terrible jokes. And, you know, those could fall flat or be off-putting. And I think that there's the being the credible subject matter expert of the thing you're talking about, but then there's also having some personality on stage. And that's probably just as difficult because I've seen a lot of speakers, you probably have seen a lot of speakers that the information is good, but the delivery just falls flat, that it's not engaging and it's not entertaining, that you just can't pay attention to it because you're just bored out of your mind. You know, how important is it, or how does one prepare to actually be lively on stage? How much of it is you over projecting to feel like, you know, you're not just delivering something that's very flat?
I actually don't think it's that important. When you think about that three E's framework, what you have to do is over deliver on one of them. You have to over. If you are sharing information that's so valuable, I don't care what you look like, how you say it, as long as I can get the data, get the information, and I see, oh, this is super valuable. There are some speakers I know who, yeah, they speak in a monotone, but you listen to every word they say and you're furiously taking notes because you're like, oh my god, if I don't capture all this, I'm going to miss it and I'm going to lose out on the value. There are other speakers who are rip-roaringly funny, and that's what they do best, is they are damn funny people. By the time they're done talking, you've laughed so hard, your sides hurt. You may not have any idea what they talked about, but they were funny as hell. And then there are those speakers who are so emotionally inciting that, you know, you're motivated or you're angry or whatever. And again, you may not have any idea what they talked about, but you are sure pissed off or whatever. I certainly don't advocate that you make pissing people off your the cornerstone of thing, unless that's what you're really good at. So I think it's something you said that is important. It's not over-projecting who you are, but it is absolutely projecting in who you are and having a conversation with the audience about what it is that they care about. That's the other part of the engagement. If you can figure out using tools like analytics or even something as simple as talking to people before you go on stage, what it is that they really want to hear, then you will be engaging.
Speaking of engaging, here's something that I often wonder about. In the day and age that we live in, where social media is such an important part of a brand or brand awareness, how important is it for the deck itself to be engaging, that it has those Instagrammable moments, that it has those slides that people are taking pictures of and sharing and tweeting and posting? Because I think that there's also this added pressure on a speaker to have not just the content and the authority, but also sort of the visual aspect of the deck so that people feel compelled to share and reshare it on social media. What are your thoughts on that?
So that's a really good question. There's two approaches, and you have to do both. The first is you need to know your talk hold so well that if the projector doesn't work or the power is out or whatever, you can deliver your entire talk without a visual. You may have to adapt parts of it. You can't say, and looking at this slide that isn't here, but you can say, and we found that the week of January 29th, 2018 was the week to send email. You know your talk so well that you can deliver it without assistance. And going back to what you're saying earlier, that's one of the things that new speakers especially are over-reliant on their presentations because they have not done their rehearsals. But your second point is also really good, which is in an age of sharing and the ubiquitous smartphone and making an impression on people, you either want your talk to be wildly shared with people taking pictures of like every slide, or you want people to be taking notes so furiously that they don't have time to share something, and then they share in afterwards. Either way, it still comes down to knowing your audience and talking to them and understanding why they're in the room. And that's, again, that's something that people don't do very well, particularly newer speakers. If you think about what the audience wants and why they're in the room, you can create those moments that will be shared. I mean, think back to when you were talking on stage at Inbound. You left a substantial amount of time for Q&A, and that was the best thing you could have done because it let the audience really engage and ask complex questions.
And that they did. But thankfully, you know, you and John had prepared me so well that I think there was only one question that somebody was able to stump me on. And it was really a question that was better suited to your skill set. But, you know, on that note of being prepared, I had gotten into the practice of reciting my presentation out loud while I was doing the dishes, while I was vacuuming, while I was walking the dog, because learning from people who've done it before me and people who do it so well, it really stuck out that it was so important that you can't rely on the technology to guide you. Having notes, having the slides as the cues isn't good enough. It was interesting when I was preparing for the talk, the person who was running the AV was asking me how I wanted the slide deck prepared for me. He's like, "Do you have notes?" And I was like, "Nope, I don't have any notes." He's like, "Okay, the person before you, every single one of their slides, they had scripted out. And so their monitor that they were looking at was enlarged so that they could literally read their script." And I tried that tactic when I first started putting the talk together, and I found it to be so distracting. Mm-hmm. that the story didn't come out organically. It felt too choppy because I was starting and stopping and trying to find my place and relying too heavily on the script. And so what I can say as a newer speaker is know it cold, to your point. Know it without having to rely on the slides. You should basically, in your mind, be able to visualize slide by slide. Now, that said, I know that, Chris, one of the things that you do is when you build your deck, your decks don't have a lot of text on the slides themselves. It's mostly just visuals and images. And for you, those images are the cue, to your point, where you and the audience are sort of bookmarking where you are of, okay, I'm now looking at a picture of a unicorn. That means I'm now talking about this section here. What is your own personal opinion on decks that are too text heavy versus decks that have no text?
We know neurologically in people that your brain's language center is relatively new, evolutionarily speaking. And it is, in the world of computers, it is a serial processor. It can do one thing at a time really well. Your visual cortex is a much older part of your brain, and it can multitask. The neurologically unsound but still popular left brain, right brain thing is sort of the analogy of the two. When you have words on a screen, you're occupying the language center, which means that your ears can no longer listen until you're done reading. If you were to hold a piece of paper up right now while you're listening to me talk, you can't do both well at the same time. So by having images on screen, you're engaging a different part of the brain that can visually look at the image, but leave the language processor relatively free to listen to the speaker. And so from a neuroscience perspective, you want to have as few words on screen as possible, the exception being if the word itself is kind of like an image. So if it's a huge, big, bold printed word, this is like, you know, a word like stop on the slide, you don't need a lot of language processing power to process that. But when you have somebody who pastes an entire paragraph on their screen, it's like, that's you're confusing the brain. So regardless of preference, you kind of have to do what works for people's brains. It's the same concept as overloading them. You don't want to try and throw so much at them that their brain just shuts down and can't process anymore. And again, my hands up, if you could see the video, my hands up, I'm super guilty of just backing the truck up and dumping stuff on people's heads.
It sounds like speaking is an art form. It's a practice. It's a methodology. So the things that we've talked about are new speaker, seasoned speaker, practice makes perfect. So there's really no reason to not have, you know, your talk down cold, or at least have the framework in your mind. And with the framework should tell a story so that it's a logical flow from start to finish, so that you're actually bringing your audience on a journey with you and you're telling a story. You're not just throwing information at them that's all disconnected and disjointed.
I want to actually tag on to that. Because people like to talk about the art and science. Speaking begins as a science and evolves to an art. So the science is the best practices. Like, you know, you can't have words on slides. You know you have to rehearse.
Right.
And there's absolutely a science to that. And then as you become comfortable with it, it becomes the art. You become, so like when you first started your rehearsals, you were very much in the, okay, I'm just going to follow the steps. And by the time you got on stage, you had freed your mind of so much of the mechanics that you were able to focus more on the art of the delivery.
So as we're starting to wrap up and pull it all together, any other tips and tricks that you've learned along the way or that surprised you that people do when they're public speaking?
I think probably the most controversial one is the use of things like profanity and intentionally insensitive language or imagery and things. And it's one of those things that has to be consistent with your brand. There are some speakers for whom their brand of being in your face is requires them to speak that way. But there's an old Oscar Wilde quote. It says, "Be yourself because everyone else is already taken." And I think if we were to leave on any note, it would be that. It would be, yes, learn from other speakers, watch other speakers, learn how they do what they do, but don't try to be somebody else, because they're already taken, and you're always, it's better to be the best version of yourself than a terrible copy of somebody else. And you'll always be a copy if you're trying to slavishly imitate someone else.
This got deep.
It's, yeah.
I mean, no, it's interesting because I think public speaking, you know, there's this level of a persona as a public speaker, but you still have to be authentic. You still have to be genuine. You still have to be you. And I think that all of these insights and tips and tricks that you've given are really useful. And, you know, again, for me as a new speaker, they were things that I wasn't necessarily aware of. When I first started, I was under the impression that I needed to be just like you, or I needed to deliver the way that you delivered. And I found very quickly that what was comfortable for me wasn't necessarily the way that you do it. And that was okay, because I still was able to deliver on the talk that I was asked to give. And so I think, you know, your point is a really good one to end on, is regardless of what you learn and see, the methodology is the same, but the art has to be yours and authentic.
Exactly right. If you're interested in speaking more, I definitely would recommend picking up Michael Port's book, Steal the Show. I think it's a fantastic book. Also pick up Presentation Zen by Gar Reynolds, which is a good book on how you design the talk itself. And as always, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to our newsletter at trustinsights.ai. Thank you for listening to In Ear Insights, the Trust Insights podcast. Please ask a coworker or colleague to follow our show on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your shows. Got a question you'd like us to answer? Want some help solving your data and analytics challenges? Visit us at www.trustinsights.ai today.